The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Fun, the For Us Network.
Please fasten your seatbelts.
Hello and welcome to Sock It to Politics, where we get this, Sock It to Politics. Joining me, as always, are esteemed panelists, Aaron Seal from Montreal. Hello, Aaron.
Hello, everyone. Pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you. And joining us from the left coast is Hafiz Nourani, who just took a sip of coffee and almost choked. Hello, Hafiz.
I'm alive. I'm making it. I survived my coffee.
Yeah.
Good morning to you, gentlemen.
I don't know if I would ever recommend you being near very hot beverages. I just get this impression that that's danger.
Oh, it is danger. Definitely danger. Don't put me anywhere near soup.
All right. All right, let's continue. This week, we're going to talk about Julie Payette, the outgoing governor general. We're going to talk about, speaking of outgoing, we're going to talk about three different caucus expulsions. Wow, that sounded dirty.
I had one of those last night.
Hey, Beavis, check it out. And we're also going to talk about, first, we're going to finish out the interesting things on the list from the World Economic Forum predictions for 2030. We're going to drop two of the list because they're kind of either dated or sort of snores. You know, we don't want to bother you with a snore fest. So we'll go into the interesting things. The first one they're predicting is, they say, farewell hospital, hello homespital. Okay, so they need a little work on marketing. But they're saying that technology will make it so that the hospital will be on the way out with fewer accidents thanks to self-driving cars and great strides in preventive and personalized medicine. Scalpels and organ donors are out. Tiny robotic tubes and bioprinted organs are in. Does anybody believe this kind of utopian crap? What do you think, Aaron?
Well, it's not a matter of belief for me. I hope it happens. I sure hope we move towards a technology-focused healthcare revolution, a home healthcare revolution. And for me, this is the number one priority of the decade for me. If the 2010s were a technology boom and a data analytics boom in the IT space, for me, the priority right now for this decade has to be health and wellness. It was, in a sense, brought upon us by the global pandemic. But there were problems with the healthcare system, both systems in Canada and around the world beforehand. In Canada specifically, the issue was institutional control and the cracks, the bureaucratic cracks in the system that flow from that. Healthcare, national healthcare in Canada started as an outflow of community drives towards better service delivery, better quality of healthcare service. And Tommy Douglas, when he spearheaded the move towards universal healthcare first in Saskatchewan and then nationally, the goal was accessible quality service delivery. But like in any institution that gets controlled by government, doesn't matter if you're in the energy sector, if you're in any of the aerospace, in the airlines or anything else, the longer government takes control of a sector, the more bureaucratized it will become. Now, there are moments where you want a really institutional healthcare system, and a global pandemic is probably at the top of the list. But what comes after this? When the moment comes, when we look towards the future, when we're past this moment, will we be dealing with mental health as the number one issue? How deeply will we be taking on the long-term care issue for our seniors? For me, those are the two big issues, the two big weaknesses in healthcare healthcare as it is now. Those are the worst parts of the system. So how do we improve? How do we deal with them? For me, it's not going to come from more bureaucracy. And it's not going to come from more union wrangling. We need innovation. We need more technology. We need to harness the gains that we've gotten through the behavior shifts that have come through the pandemic. We know healthcare is stodgy. Doctors are resistant to technology. Now they're doing Zoom conferences with their patients. Let's harness that spirit and let's drive towards better in the places where healthcare needs it.
But do you think it's possible by 2030?
In ways. We won't get rid of hospitals completely, but the idea that the general practitioner meeting will be done by teleconference and that the services that are required out of those ongoing interactions will be delivered electronically, we're already a heck of a ways there.
All right, Hafiz, your thoughts before I share mine?
Well, look, if you got to look at where the technology is now. We have a lot of interesting technology in health monitoring especially like your Apple Watch can give you phenomenal readings about your heart conditions. And anyone with a heart condition these days with an Apple Watch can feed raw data into an application that can be monitored by your doctor and sent the information sent to your doctor without you even leaving your house. So you can get day-to-day accurate on-time information. Now, you can also look at the clinical trials right now for 3D printed skin, which is skin is one of the biggest organs on the human body. So
it's actually the biggest.
It is the biggest,
yeah. And that includes porn stars.
Yeah, yeah. Because there's skin on that too. So
I hope so.
me too. But anyway, I digress. You can get 3D printed skin coming onto the market relatively soon. And there are other 3D printed organs, less complex organs that they're looking at. They're also looking at parts of hearts and whatnot. So this is 2020, and they've been talking about that stuff since 2010 to 2020 when it started first coming around with 3D printable tissue. But now the concept of that being more central in 2030, I mean, we're 1 year into this decade. I can see that becoming more of a thing. Telemedicine and the system of a doctor coming to you. This is new in North America, but elsewhere in the world, it isn't. France already has a system similar to this, where the doctor comes sees you, you don't go see the doctor. It basically reduces cross-contamination of patients in a large area, which is something we're going through now, and also reduces stress on the transportation system and make sure that six people don't have to go see the doctor, but there's a doctor that comes sees them, and a doctor goes around and just drives from patient to patient.
All right, first of all, let's start with the last thing you said. There used to be house calls. Doctors used to make house calls. It was a thing. They stopped it because doctors can see more patients in a day if they don't have to spend time traveling than they can if they have to go from place to place, because some of your patients could be fairly remote from your office. So I don't see, considering that we're moving towards things being faster and streamlined, I don't see going backwards to where doctors have to engage the time to go from place to place and thereby reducing their billings substantially day by day. I'm not seeing that happening.
It depends on the case, really, because it's like, so like Aaron said, there's a percentage that will definitely go to telemedicine, because if you have the data being fed from some sort of transmitter on your body to a doctor that can analyze you. And then we also have, the phone and camera technology to get more detailed looks of temperature and what's going on with the human being. They don't even need to physically be around you. But if it's a more, it's a call where they physically have to see you, yeah, maybe the doctor can go, because transportation by 2020, which is the other thing we're going to get to, is going to be a lot, by 2030 is going to be a lot faster.
Self-driving cars is still awesome. Distance, though. Distance is still, yeah. Distance. Speed limits will still be speed limits.
We're not the 1870s where we have like some doctor in a horse carriage having to go from like one city to another. We're talking about urban.
Did you say 1870s or 1970s?
I don't know. Same thing to me, really.
In the 1970s, there still were doctors doing house calls. But
if I could jump in on this,
yeah,
you could flip the perspective. You're looking at this from the perspective of the doctor's time. There are moments where the doctor's investment of time, including travel, might be worthwhile, even though the doctor has to spend time on the road, if you look at it from a patient's perspective, because one of the driving forces for home healthcare is the idea that patient outcomes are better if the patient can recover in their own home versus in hospital. I'm not saying this is going to be the case for all medical procedures. You can give absurd examples, as many as you want. But for a lot of times, if you've got a patient who's sitting in a hospital, whether in a ward or in a room, and is seeing a doctor maybe once or twice a week, but is largely being monitored or maybe attended to by a nurse or a social worker, a lot of those types of medical services might move to the home, and you might judge that some of the ancillary costs associated with home service delivery are worth paying.
Those won't be your doctor. Those will be the same way now you can get, if you're elderly, you can get people coming in and healthcare workers coming in and checking on you a couple times a week. It's not your doctor. It's a specific service. I can see that happening because it's already happening. But as far as just where you normally would go to the doctor's office for a checkup or you go because you, well, I don't know who goes for checkups anymore. But you go because something is bothering you. You've got a particular ailment. Some of those things will be able to be solved through Zoom calls or even telephone calls. My doctor does it on telephone right now. Those things are not going to go away, but you're still, you need to see a doctor.
How does a doctor just diagnose sock issues? Like what? The hand that you have in you, like, is that the major thing?
Go drink some coffee and maybe you'll choke. But you still, when you have to see a doctor, if you want to see your doctor, there may be some services. Like, listen, there's veterinary services right now that will come to your house and do the veterinary services at your house, but it isn't your veterinarian. It'll be the same thing. There may be some doctor services where they will come to your house, but if you want to see your doctor who has your patient history and knowledge and so on, you're still going to have to go into the doctor's office. The example of sitting in a hospital bed, yeah, if you can sit at home and there's somebody to monitor you, but if you need 24-hour monitoring, you're still going to have to be in a hospital. And I don't think we're anywhere close to 3D printed organs yet. I've been hearing that 3D printed organs were around the corner for 15 years. And at this point, 3D printers themselves haven't really caught on like people predicted they would. And we're still nowhere near being able to make anything as complex as a functioning organ. So I think 2030, it's a little bit premature that we're going to be there by 2030. All of these things are possible, but I think the timetable is completely outrageous. Let's move on to, we are eating less meat. Do you think that that's going to happen?
I won't be. I am an unapologetic carnivore. And for me, this is almost identity defining. Because I'll tell you one of the things when I came out of depression, because I sank into an unimaginably severe depression through the later part of the 2010s. And much like Jordan Peterson and a few others that you read about in the media, one of the keys to the pivot out of it for me was just being unapologetic. I'll eat what my body wants, which at the pivot point was basically bone broth, beef, and water. Now it's moved to a bit more of a diversified keto type thing, but I've basically cut out carbs completely and I go heavy on meat proteins. For me, this is a key element and a fundamental element of my personal wellness strategy, if you want to call it that. And I'm not the only one. Now, I'm not saying that should be universal either. One of the things that I hope we see in this decade, or at least over my lifetime, is an acknowledgement of diversity on food science and on body needs. The things that my body needs and wants are probably not the same as those of a person of a different upbringing, heritage, or just literally anyone else. Everybody's body is different. And the idea that a food guide should apply to everyone, in my mind, is nonsense. For me, the innovation that I'm looking to see is on how food is made, on agricultural processes, on animal raising processes, things like lab engineered chicken that we read about. Need alternatives for people who want them, but also the idea that we can actually get an animal protein in a more healthy environment. Those are the types of innovations that for me, I'm looking to see.
Hafiz, you wanted to pop in there?
I was just agreeing with Aaron on the lab grown meat. There's a company called Memphis Meats out of the US, and you can get lab grown chicken breasts that you can make fried chicken with, and they're in the States apparently. I'm dying to try this.
They're probably very expensive
right now. Yes, but like
$200 a breast.
Well, no, not so much.
Like a prostitute. Right.
Anyway, getting back to the topic, I think a lot of what you see on this people eating less meat right now, you got to understand where that came from. And it's I think when society looks back at this period between 2010 and 2020, there's all this sort of wellness pseudoscience that went on, and it had a drastic influence all throughout the world on even things that are scientific. And there was a major push for eating less meat and veganism and attaching that to ecology and environmentalism. But I feel like all of that was always just like some sort of 1850s barber cutting off arms to stop like some sort of wound. Like it just doesn't make sense. There's other solutions to these things. And I think a lot of what we've seen with veganism and sort of this movement towards less meat has sort of backfired. And a lot of people I know that have switched to veganism end up switching back because they have vitamin deficiencies. And this has happened to people within, you know, my own close circle and family too. So I would say, you know, there's going to be more common sense solutions. And there's people that do not want to eat meat, and you know, ethical reasons why. But I think there'll be ethical solutions to how meat is processed and animals are sort of culled for the meat industry. You're also seeing like a lot of people trying to push eating of insects, and I don't think that's going to catch on either.
What?
Yeah,
you know, there's some whole cultures where that's normal.
That's just it. But I
saw Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. I understand that some cultures eat food differently than we do.
That was a very, very racist Indiana Jones.
Oh, you mean that wasn't accurate?
No. I mean, well, like looking back at that, I was like, holy shit. Did they actually put that out as how a culture consumes food? Either way, but going back to the insect thing, it was a movement and still is to push this concept of eating bugs. And you know, you go to some of these sort of like funny little urban markets and whatnot, you'll see people starting to produce this kind of stuff. And I don't see it catching on. And in North American sense, we have such great access to beef. I'm sorry. One thing I can see is Alberta continuing to make beef. There's not that many Canadians in this great land of ours. We have enough room to graze cows and eat that cattle. Now, if other parts of the world can't afford meat, then there is an issue over there, and there will be other solutions to that. But I don't think we're going to get worldwide veganism, because you're going to have the whole world get depressed, slow, and lethargic.
Well, the truth is that not everybody who has a vegan diet is depressed, slow, and lethargic. Just the people you see working at vegan stores. They're the people that you walk in there and it's like their eyes are downcast, their skin is ashen. You ask them to reach something on an upper shelf, they can't raise their arms. That's different. There are people for whom I know somebody who is a vegan, not because of ethical or moral issues, but because she just can't digest meat. It just doesn't work for her biology. Her biology. As for eating bugs, I don't know. We'd have to ask people in the Tour de France, because I'm pretty sure they eat bugs as they're driving pretty fast. I hope that we move towards more humane treatment of animals. These factory farms seem to be... The trend seems to be away from them towards more free range, better, more ethically raised meat. I think that's a solution for those who have ethical concerns.
I don't know about you guys, but like I grew up in another culture where like, you know, in India, when you went to pick up chicken, you went to this guy that had a sort of like a little mini slaughter thing, and you'd see the chickens in the backyard, and it was sort of like they would have a life. And I find the produce when I, like if I taste chicken or eggs outside of North America, you see this kind of natural flavor coming out of them. And I hope North America can get back to that.
I will say, I can't at all relate to that childhood story that you described. I certainly didn't see those types of chickens myself. But in terms of quality, I can say that there is a distinct difference in the taste of chicken, depending on whether you get standard supermarket fare or genuine free range, depending on how it's fed.
Yeah, absolutely. And
those are the types of quality differences on food that I hope we pay attention to more in the coming decade. Like I think we turned, certainly in the late 20th century, we turned very much towards convenience. In the 21st century, it became even easier as delivery became ubiquitous, but the missing factor a lot of the time is quality. And if we improve ingredients, and if we turn towards like personal control through DIY, these types of things lead to better lives, frankly, because we're eating better. So quality through better ingredients for me is high on the list.
Yeah, like I have a friend that has chickens now, and you know they have enough chickens that they have enough eggs for the whole week, and it's like they taste the difference between this animal that's at it that's around them that's loved, and those eggs that you get at the store, and I think that's the question we gotta start asking is, how well do we take care of the things that we eat? And I think that's going to be a big question. And I'm glad this movement of veganism did happen because it did point out where our flaws are. But I think there's better solutions than being, you know, cutting out things entirely.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is you don't see the word vegan on packaging anymore. It's all called plant-based. They've all shifted. It's like when they went from being liberals to progressives in the U.S., and they're virtually the same thing. Just one word got a stink on it, and so they moved to something else. So vegan and vegetarian.
Hey, I'm fine with liberals coming back and being labeled as something center, and progressives being labeled.
Well, I'm fine with that too. I've never really had a problem with the term liberal. But in Canada, we have a party called Liberal. In the States, they're the ones that poisoned it. But you got everything that used to be called vegan and vegetarian is now called plant-based. Every plant-based food, plant-based burger, it's as if they're trying to convince
plant-based
us.
Plant-based toilet paper.
Perhaps so. Corn husks.
Corn husks.
It's like they're trying to convince us that the earlier stuff that was vegan and vegetarian, which purported to taste like meat and tasted like no meat anybody had ever eaten, like forget about that stuff because they've made great strides now. The stuff tastes... you know, depending on the brand, you can get stuff that tastes pretty much like the original thing if you get the right brands. If you get the cheap brands, you get what you pay for. But
yeah,
more and more when I go shopping in the grocery store, I see you've got the meat and you've got a huge section of meat alternatives. We've already seen a huge growth in meat alternatives. And I think that's only going to continue. Will we ever see people wholesale abandoning meat? No. Because there's people like my friend Aaron and like myself who actually...
And me.
Well, do you need... Have you ever gone off meat and then discovered that you're not feeling well? You need meat?
If I don't eat meat and I don't get that source of protein, I feel weaker. I feel like my body doesn't function as great. I mean... I can eat in India. You can have a vegetarian diet, but it has milk proteins and other proteins in it to compensate. And that's the only culture I've ever been able to eat like non-meat products, but I still have animal products in me. Right?
Well, so. I'm lactose intolerant, so the dairy thing ain't working with me. I need meat. I find that I don't need meat all the time, but I need it often enough. And there's people who say that's nonsense, nobody needs meat. It's like, you know what, don't tell me what I need and don't need. Biodiversity is a thing. And I'm surprised, Aaron, you're such an intelligent guy, so articulate. I understood that carbs were important for brain function, and you don't have any carbs.
Well, I eat plenty of carbs when I was
he
young.
He fell into the carb thing when he was a kid.
No, he pays a carb tax,
I'll admit that.
All right. And let's go on to the final thing from the World Economic Forum, which is that by 2030, we'll be ready to move humans toward the red planet. Now, this doesn't say we'll be on there. It says move them toward the red planet. We can move humans toward the red planet now. We just can't get them there alive. chief scientist of NASA at the time said, once we get there, we'll probably discover evidence of alien life. That I think was an interesting nugget, because if the person who's the chief scientist at NASA is saying that, they're telling us that they probably have seen signs of alien life, as far as I'm concerned. Otherwise, all these tests that have come back negative would have them believe otherwise. That's a biggie for me. But do we really think that we'll be close to landing on Mars in 2030, Aaron?
Well, for me, I embrace the sense of ambition, but I think it's the wrong target. I don't think space exploration is on my list of priorities for the 2020s. And if I look back at why space was a priority in the 20th century, For me, if you're a space fan, I will salute you, but I'm not one of you. This is not a priority for me. I see space exploration history as a political vanity project by selected leaders, which in many cases was an outflow of the Cold War. So for me, I don't see much merit in investing, whether the money, the time, or just the space in the public dialogue for that type of, like, literally pie in the sky project. For me, the types of things we've been talking about so far, questions of healthcare, questions of diet, questions of industry, for me, the cracks in society right now require an inward focus. And there are periods through history where that's required, whether it's the Industrial Revolution on the economic side. You talk about periods like Romanticism in French history, Shakespearean England, when culture was developed there. Like, there are times when you need an inward sort of batten the hatches, build society focus. For me, that's what it is. It's sort of not looking at the sky right now.
All right, Hafiz, your thoughts?
I think there's been a heavy investment into space exploration again, and the technology of making space travel more affordable as a business venture, and for private companies, as well as for as a national venture by countries. Will we reach Mars is a big question. I think we will have someone land on Mars. I think we might move towards setting up some sort of base on the moon to launch to Mars, but I don't think any of this will be in full fruition by 2030, because I don't think that's our main focus right now as a society, as Aaron said. I think right now we need to fix our planet more than anything, in terms of how we use energy. And I think once we solve that energy function of moving away from fossil fuels and looking at alternate sources of energy, we're going to find other sources that are going to help us leave this planet faster and with more powerful energy behind us.
You know, I find myself agreeing with Aaron in a sense that I think that space exploration is a form of bread and circuses. It's a form of, hey, look over there. There's a bright future ahead. And I understand that it plays into human curiosity. Questions like, are we alone in the universe? Which, you know, I saw E.T., we're not.
Billionaires like Elon Musk and whatnot are throwing their money into this because they want to go to space and they want to live on Mars. And I say, fuck them, let them go. Because they're going to get there and realize that there's no one there to fucking help them do anything.
Well, private space exploration may be part of the equation. If a billionaire wants to put billionaire money towards the project, and if they're not harming any, or if we can limit the environmental damage, and if he or she is willing to cooperate with government, that may well be the path. That's different from the NASA expeditions that we've known over the 20th century.
Yeah, and I think, like I said, I think it's going to be largely privately funded, because even if you look at something like SpaceX and the reusable rockets, that's exactly what you just said. It's the business solutions come in, it's become more environmentally friendly because now you're reusing those rockets, and the cost is coming down so that these billionaires can get to space. And then if you look at the competition between Richard Branson and all these guys, they're all trying to get to that platform where they can have their little space vacation over the Earth and look down upon all of us like they do metaphorically.
Well, you know, they talk about space mining, which seems practical, getting rare elements out of meteors and so on. But I still think you can do that cheaper on Earth. We're not out of elements. We're not out of ores.
It's not being out of elements. It's what they might find otherwise, or larger proportions of rare earth elements that might be.
But the idea
easier
of mining a moving thing like an asteroid or a comet, it won't be done by humans. It's all very science fiction, because the amount that you'd have to take off of the asteroid or the body in space has to be immense. It can't do, you know, it's not like you see in TV shows where they find a vein of gold and they get out like 9 gold bars. It have to be, for the investment, the amount there has to be massive. And in order to get it down to Earth and refined, you're going to have to use numerous rock. It seems like...
What? You're telling me I I can't believe in mining on meteors and all this in like 2030 to 2040. That's too far fetched. But I can sit here and talk with a friend that's a sock, that's a scientifically designed piece of amazingness, and that's real. No, I believe in this mining in the future.
Well, one of those things is really happening.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. No, if you told me. Yeah, you're a scientific marvel.
Aaron, help me out here.
Well, what I think Hafiz is saying is some of the things that seem far-fetched today seem very realistic when they actually happen. And like, if you look at the way we're managing our lives in the midst of the pandemic now, we are using tools that didn't exist 15 or 20 years ago. Like, imagine the pandemic without Facebook or Twitter. Just imagine what it would be like. Imagine if we only had analog TV like in the 80s. So
in 2000s, we didn't think of having these Zoom calls. I mean, we could look at each other's silly faces if we wanted to on these recordings.
Yeah, the podcast as a concept, I'm pretty sure it didn't exist, or it was pretty remotely.
Wait a second, just to clarify, Aaron, when you say analog TV like the 80s, would there also be 80s TV shows on though? Because then I could handle it.
But we have 80s TV shows now, and we have them on our phones. We can look up every episode of Cheers if we want to. Like, that blows the minds of, like, people in my parents' generation.
I think the 80s revival is going to continuously happen in future society, in future generations. And you're going to be, like, I don't know, 80 years old, and there will be another 80s revival.
But the 80s were a fabulous decade on culture, and we can talk about
that's
that
why.
In a poor manner, because we all have access to it in a way that they didn't have in the 80s. And it's only 40 years. So in my mind, the answer to your question, Ed, we kind of have to dream big, because the big dreams can come true. And we have evidence of that in our daily lives.
But you also said that we shouldn't be spending money on space exploration, which is based on dreaming big. If it's not
through the government, it's through dreaming, the bureaucracy,
through the government. Yeah. Let the billionaires spend that money and do that, and let society benefit from their findings.
All right. Those are the World Economic Forum predictions that we've discussed last episode and this episode. I think that we overall agree that the 2030 projection is unrealistic, at least for most of these things. The world may be moving in the direction that they're indicating, but not that fast. So we'll have to watch and see. I really think that maybe if they'd said 2050, I might have been a little bit more okay. I can see that by then. But by 2030, the futurists have always been wrong about target deadlines, about when things would come true. They're usually right about the thing happening, but they're usually off by a good 20 years as to when it's gonna happen. So we'll see if I'm still here in 2050, who the hell knows? I could be sitting somewhere crapping my diapers.
Robot Ed. We'll have Robot Ed as your replacement.
Yeah, just put my brain in a robot body. That actually would be really cool. Why is that on the list? We can put our brains in robot bodies. I want that.
I don't.
You don't?
I kind of like my body as it is.
Yeah, but it's going to wear out. When your body wears out, wouldn't you like to be in like some ass-kicking RoboCop-type body? Wouldn't that be amazing?
I don't know. I'm getting a little scared.
You'd rather get old, lose your teeth, and crap your pants?
Look, I'm fine with reincarnation. I believe in that. I'm going to spend my next reincarnation as some micro amoeba in a cave and just drip on things for a while. And
you could say that's what you're doing now.
Well, then it's not far off. I'm practicing for my next life.
All right. Next life, next topic. Julie Payette, the governor general, resigning in disgrace after a report confirmed earlier reports that she was a tyrant in her office, that she was peculiar and a tyrant. And I have to wonder, does somebody need to wear this other than Julie Payette for her own behavior? Is this something that the government or Trudeau has to wear? Because she seemed like an ideal candidate, really. And
oh, that's BS. She was not an ideal candidate. She was a liberal partisan, whether she held a membership or not. Like, Justin Trudeau ditched the process that Stephen Harper used, put together, which was applauded and has been mirrored at the provincial level. And he went back to the old close the doors, dim the lights, and let's pick the one we want, the one that looks the part, the one that we can trust, the one who has ties to us in the Michael Jean tradition. And no, I don't think that she was a quality candidate. She had reputational star power, but she was also an insider. And if this is the way she treated staff, then she kind of deserves her fate. And if that's the character that she showed, you have to wonder whether Justin Trudeau should have been more aware of that beforehand. But for me, it's a bigger picture issue for Justin Trudeau, because the idea that the governor general, the chosen governor general of this Liberal prime minister, would be so self-centered and put her own interest first to this degree, both in terms of her spending habits and her personal behavior. Yes, I pin that one on Justin too. And I think it plays into an entitlement narrative that he's going to have to deal with if he wants to avoid political peril.
I don't know. I think that you think of some of the other governors general that we've had, they also came across optically in a good way. And that's why they got the job. A hero, an astronaut, a scientist. She seemed, on the outside, she seemed like a good representative for the Queen. She seemed like a heroic figure. And I don't know if there were indications before that she was this bad. I have not read that there were indications that she was this kind of tyrant before. She may not have had the opportunity before to be this. This job may have brought it out in her. I think ultimately this hangs on her for terrible behavior. She has to be responsible for the behavior that she put forward. Hafiz?
Look, I look at who the governor general was before in the Harper era, and I think David Johnston was kind of like the ideal governor general for a modern age, even though he wasn't sort of, he kind of fits this narrative of the old style, old stock Canadian. Yeah. But if you look at what he did in the transition from Harper to Trudeau, and even the situation when we had the shooting at the House of Commons, he was kind of a central figure in sort of the tensions and resolving that and giving sort of this dark time in Canada a better face in the transition. If you look at his predecessors, Adrian Clarkson and Michelle Jean, they were both air in the nose elitists. I think Julie Payette. I think this is a situation of looking at what someone is rather than who someone is, and it ticked off all the liberal boxes of, you know, a well-educated woman leader, and they didn't really look at who she is as a person. And this comes back to my narrative about but anything where it's based on, oh, we need to hire more of this, like one type of person, male, female, black, white, brown. I think we need to go back to hiring based on who someone is more than anything and how they fit into an environment. And I don't think that's taken into account anymore because we're too focused on what people are and the color of their skin and their gender and so on and so forth.
Well, I have a hard time arguing with that rationale. Aaron?
Well, it's a question of institutions in some senses. Like, I agree. We need to focus less on like the text of a resume and like the data approach to hiring. Whereas Hafiz says, you just tick off the boxes. Character matters. Now that's not to say that we shouldn't, that we should dismiss some of the protections on prejudice issues, because that's one of the reasons why we institutionalize processes, because if you move too far in a direction of decentralization and sort of touch and feel judgments, people fall by the wayside. But character matters, and I definitely think the workplace became sterilized in the 2000s and 2010s for completely legitimate and good reasons. But we've lost the human factor in a lot of cases, and we need to bring it back.
All right. Any predictions as to who the next Governor General will be? I know that it will not be Don Cherry, which was trending on Twitter. Maybe that's just too, an unfair question because it's very there's so many nominees.
Governor at the sock. I want to see it. I say we start the movement now.
Totally on board for that.
You think there was trouble with Julie Payette?
Well, look, men have failed. Women have failed. It's time for socks to take the
You'll be honest. Like, you'll shit disturb, but you'll do it intentionally.
Yeah.
But is it the job of the Governor General to shit disturb? I think it's kind of the opposite.
I think, you know what, you got to point out all the things in Canadian society and make us all feel better. And that's something you do every day on these shows.
And when you have to execute vice regal duties, you'll take them seriously. The rest of the time, you'll make a fool of yourself.
Yeah, that's
well, you make it sound so attractive, Aaron. All right.
I think that's what Canadians want in a representative of the Queen. Because, I mean, if you look at all our other representatives, they're complete fuck anyway. So.
Well, I love the rationale being used. Everybody else is so lousy, you might as well have Ed. I must say that I'm touched by the esteem in which you held me. All right, let's move on to talking about caucus expulsions. We've got three to talk about. I'm going to turn it over to Aaron to introduce this.
Yes, a tale of three expulsions, and they are distinct in my mind. Let's start with Jason Kenney, the expulsion being Pat Wren. His list is he was one of many Alberta politicians who chose to go on a global vacation during the Christmas holidays. So that's X number one. X number two is he's had local calls for his resignation on grounds of ignoring his constituents. The Alberta Urban Municipalities Association wrote to Kenney pushing for this. So that's definitely a strike number two when even on the ground they're organizing against you. And third is questionable expenses. If Jason Kenney isn't going to take action in response to that, you wonder like why he's even around, like what's his management responsibility. So that's him doing what needed to be done. Now there seems to be a wider issue in Alberta of sort of taking your eye off the ball in terms of serious leadership in response to the pandemic. Few too many people in my mind went on vacation, and Jason Kenney's going to have to do more. But for now, on Pat Wren, he did that right. In Ontario, on the other hand, you get Doug Ford expelling Roman Bobber for questioning the lockdown, which for me is way past the line. Like that, in my mind, is an MPP doing his job. And if you can't ask questions about literally the most important issue of our time, then when your constituents want you to be doing that, then we've got serious problems with democracy. Like, the whole reason government is still operating is so we can have a discourse on these things. And in my mind, it's reflective of a specific problem within Ontario conservatism that we've talked about before. It's a very controlling variant of conservatism, and it has a very short fuse on dissent. And I think it's problematic. It's not universal, although the Ontario conservatives who prescribe to that view impose it on others in their minds and think it's universal. It's not. There is far more of an elements of compassion and community in conservatism across the country, in Quebec, Alberta, and BC with social credit traditions. But in Ontario, there's a very strong sense of discipline. In my mind, it can be taken way too far. And this expulsion by Doug Ford of this MPP for questioning the lockdown is, in my mind, an example of that. The third one, and the sort of peculiar of the bunch, if we've got the good, the bad, and the ugly, the ugly one is Aaron O'Toole and Derek Sloan. Now, don't be fooled. This one has been a long time coming. It's not an issue of 100-and-some-odd donation by a white supremacist type. Like there are deeper issues with Derek Sloan's messaging and his place within the Conservative Party because we've been hearing talk. Like we know that he organizes on the ground. This is what social conservatives do. Aaron O'Toole is personally pro-choice, but if a Derek Sloan type is mobilizing members on the ground through churches and other institutions to gain and exert influence at the membership level, at the staff level, with nominations to get preferred candidates into parliament where they can then amplify the message. Like this is the broader context that Aaron O'Toole has had in mind. Now, the consequence of choosing a single leadership donation of a three-digit magnitude is having ripple effects through the membership. Like you read on social media of EDA presidents and members of local grassroots organizers resigning in disgust. That's not good for Aaron O'Toole, and he's going to have to manage that. So the question is, was he right to do it? I would argue he should have dealt with the Derek Sloan issue really early in his mandate, in his leadership, rather than sort of giving him the Stephen Harper, Maxime Bernier treatment from Foreign Affairs, where you get this laundry list of stuff that happens, and in the end, you sort of pinpoint something along the way as the reason to get rid of him. No, you deal with the issue either by expelling him or by stating your boundaries with clarity and demanding that he work within them, or some other solution, but you deal with it quickly. You don't string it along and then sort of pull the trigger over nothing.
I mean, I don't know if there's really anything to add to that or debate. What do you think, Hafiz?
Look, I noticed that all these three parties are conservative parties. And I think in particularly with the last one, and that it's the most significant one, but I think it also stems in at least the first case, there's this bravado that is within the conservative party of being this sort of rebellious character. And it's taken a tone, I think, with people like Derek Sloan. And I mean, we've been talking about other conservative party members like Michelle Rempel, Pierre Poilievre, Candace Burden, and they've all been kind of allowing this sort of radical right information to come into play more and more. And it's been front and center in the Conservative Party. Aaron O'Toole even was trying to go after a Trumpian message, and it all backfired on January 6th. And, you know, as someone that lived through the era in Canada where being Muslim was frowned upon, and the associations of anyone that was Muslim was derived directly to some sort of terror suspect, especially in the late Harper years, I feel as though conservatism needs to answer for making a home for right-wing radicalism within its party. And it's only because it's now frowned upon and that there's no support for it whatsoever that they're making these moves. I mean, I can understand that there's some other power stuff behind there, but Derek Sloan is not the only one. And there's other conservative MPs that need to answer for why they made this shit okay.
Well, you know, the thing that that interests me is the expulsion by Doug Ford, because who does he expel? He doesn't expel people that break the rules like Rod Phillips. He, you know, somebody who clearly manipulated and was deceptive in breaking the rules the government had been emphasizing people shouldn't be breaking. That guy should have been kicked out of caucus, but he wasn't. He lost his ministerial portfolio, but he wasn't kicked out of caucus. Who does he kick out of caucus? Anybody who disagrees with him at all. There was that case of that young lady who was
Amanda Simard, the Franco-Ontarienne who was defending French language university education. You're absolutely right on this, Ed. They will expel you for voicing your views. They will expel you for doing your job in representing constituents in cases where constituents disagree with the government, but you'll turn a blind eye when it comes to the so-called family in the metaphorical sense. When Rob Phillips goes on vacation, you try to manage it and you only deal with it once it's already blown up in the media and everyone's outrage. If you actually look at the social media history on that, you'll see influential conservatives recommending that the Ford government and those around them let it blow over, that it's a nothing issue. Those people have egg on their face, but those people have influence. And it's as you say, Ed, it's reflective of an Ontario culture where you have to follow the line on the issues and they'll look the other way on conduct questions like Mr. Phillips.
Yeah, that's the thing that he doesn't get points from me for ejecting somebody for questioning a lockdown. And ignoring the fact that Rod Phillips thumbed his nose at the rules at a time when Ford was desperate to get people to take seriously the idea of not going away for Christmas. I mean, it just kneecapped the legitimacy and the authenticity of what Ford was asking. That is more harmful than asking questions. And so to turf Roman Baber about this, I think he's offside. It becomes a cult of you must follow what dear leader says, except for certain people and except for certain transgressions. There's no even-handedness here. And so I think that it was that, as you said, he went way over the line with that expulsion. The other thing,
there's an authoritarianness to each of these guys, though. If you look at whether it's Jason Kenney or Doug Ford, it's their way, they're the party. It's not about a consent amongst conservative leaders. It's just the leader. And I think conservatism as a movement needs to change that.
I think that I don't think that Jason Kenney had any choice but to expel that member. Because
he was forced into it, though. But I'm talking more about in terms of dissent within these parties. Jason Kenney hasn't really had that because everyone in his party is a moron. But if you look at the Progressive Conservative Party in Ontario, there was still a different wing that wasn't Doug Ford. And I believe that wing has been silenced more and more, and it's a different party post-Doug. And that's a little bit concerning, and I think it's no longer that old Progressive Conservative Values Party, and it's more of this new Trump light Doug Ford party.
Well, Fies, I think you're drawing the equivalence that I was talking about earlier. I don't think Doug Ford and Jason Kenney are the same. I think in the Ontario controlling variant of conservatism that sometimes gets broadcasted as universal. Like if you look at the conservative governments through Klein and Stelmach, like these were governments that invested in social services. I don't think you can equate provincial variants of conservatism. I think Jason Kenney has, as you say, Ed, acted on one problematic MP, but he definitely needs to strengthen his caucus. There are holes that are now going to be filled, and he needs to fill them with quality talent that are going to do the work. But I disagree, Hafiz, that any sort of single variant of conservatism should be applied across the country. Like the idea of expelling a Roman Baber for voicing his opinions on the lockdown, that is one political party in one province that chose to take that action, which we disagree with. François Legault isn't assured because he leans right to do the same thing.
All right. I think that that brings us to a close of another episode of Sock It to Politics, during which time we socked it to politics. I don't really know what it means to sock it to politics, but apparently we do it every week. And I want to thank our sockers, Aaron Seal in Montreal. Thank you, Aaron.
Pleasure to be here.
And Hafiz Noorani sipping his now a cold cup of coffee in Vancouver.
Hey, I've gotten through the whole cup. Through this call and this episode.
I thought I sensed you building up energy. So
yeah. It's a late morning on the West Coast here for me. But I'd also want to give a shout out to Russell, Russell_C on Instagram. Thank you for your kind words about our show, and I appreciate the comments and the feedback. And any of you, if you have feedback for us in our show, reach out to us on social media. We appreciate it. We'd love to hear your thoughts on how we're doing and voices you think we should bring to the table.
And you can find Hafiz at Feezy Does It, at Feezy Does It. Aaron Seal is at Aaron Seal. Aaron is spelled with one A, and Seal like that, you know, the marine mammal. And me, I'm at Ed the Sock. Were you going to say something, Aaron?
No, I was laughing. I enjoyed that.
All right, that's it. Thank you for listening to Sock It to Politics, and Russell. All right. You know what you call a guy with no arms and no legs and a pile of leaves? Russell. All right. And on that very incorrect joke, which we can still make, but the clock is ticking, it is time to say goodbye from Sock It to Politics. I'm Ed the Sock. And you have been listening to us on the Fun Network.